This is Investigative Poetics, the true story of a daughter investigating her father's crimes. Join me, even Christine Gardner, as I examine the price of shame and the consequences of our lies. Because poetry is what survives. Investigative Poetics is a work of creative nonfiction. These stories depict actual events as truthfully as recollection permits. These stories are true, but some events have been compressed, some dialogue has been recreated, and some names and identifying details have been changed to protect the privacy of the real people involved. I didn't know what was happening until the flat of my palm crashed across my mother's face. She looked at me, shocked, aghast, her right palm cupping her cheek. "He abused me," I said. My voice was a white rage, my body a furious calm. "He abused me, and you knew it, and you allowed it." And then I carried the canvas bag of stolen money out of the house, and I rolled down the windows and drove back to Brooklyn, like a feral woman on the verge of a revelation. This episode contains references to traumatic events which may be difficult for some people. Listener discretion is advised. Previously on Investigative Poetics, this is Season 2, Episode 7, Judgment. When I was a doctoral candidate in the second year of my PhD program, I worked for a trimester on a project called Writers in the Schools. Once a week, I drove from Denver to Boulder to teach poetry to little children in a Montessori school. It was sweet work, and the commute was stunning. Along the way, I stopped to pick up a colleague who was teaching at the same school, and we drank coffee, played music, and gossiped as the sunshine played off the deep blue sky and jagged white peaks. One morning, my friend was late coming out of her building. I fiddled for 5 or 10 minutes with the radio until she appeared on the threshold, visibly flustered, her hair in disarray. She swept into the car like a bluster. "I'm sorry I'm late," she said. "I couldn't sleep. I had terrible dreams." And she went on to recount a series of visions about strangers living in her space, about a shared bathroom, and a woman handling her toiletries. She said, "It was like my worst nightmare." But it didn't sound that bad to me. "In my worst nightmare," I said, "I'm in the woods with a friend. It's a recurring dream. We're running from something we can't see. The beginning is always the same. Someone or something is chasing us, and we're running together. But then she falls down, and when I turn around, she's not there beside me. It's like she's fallen into a crevice in the rocks or stumbled into the water." The woman beside me was silent and looked down at her hands. I continued, recklessly filling the silence in the car with my words. "In the dream, I know that she's died. Her death was an accident, and her body is under the water. And then I see her mother is looking for her. She's coming through the trees. A mother desperately searching, crying out for her daughter. And I know where her body is, but it's like my mouth is sewn shut. I want to speak, but I can't say where she is." Light spilled quietly into the car. My colleague didn't meet my eye, and I sensed that I had said something wrong. "Yeah, it's a terrible dream," I said. "It's like I know something bad has happened, but I don't say anything. I hide in the trees, and then I wake up." There was a heavy silence between us as I shifted into first gear and put the car into drive. I had never told anyone about that dream before. and it would be years before I told anyone about it again. We drove the residential streets in silence, and when we got to the highway, I turned on the music, and we drove the rest of the way as if nothing had happened. Something is coming. Something is coming. The connection was unstable, and there was an edge in Cher's voice, an urgency I had not heard before. Something big is coming, and you need protection. I don't understand, I said. You must bring me three things. $2,400 in cash, $400 in quarters, and a clean white sheet. What's coming? I asked. Gather these things, she said. Bring them tomorrow. I have a white sheet, but... No, a clean white sheet. Cher was impatient. New, she said, untouched, a clean, flat, white sheet. But do you understand me? Yes, I think I understand, but... Good, she said. I will see you tomorrow. Come in the afternoon, 4 o'clock. What's coming? I asked again, but she had already hung up the phone. The safe deposit box was in the basement of an old marble bank in Brooklyn Heights. The banker led me into a little private room where I opened the box. There was the cash, no longer banded together, but instead lying flat in white envelopes, each of which contained $1,000. I took two of the envelopes and opened a third, withdrawing a few bills. I put the money into the tote bag and the rest of the cash back into the safe deposit box. Then I rang for the banker, who returned the box to the empty hole in the wall. Then I walked 5 blocks to another bank, where I withdrew $200 in quarters. They were heavy, pounds of extra weight that pulled on my thin shoulders. Finally, I walked down to the Fulton Street Mall, where I stood in the linen aisles of a TJ Maxx, a store sunken below street level. I stood there shivering in the fluorescent light, surveying the white sheets for what felt like an eternity. There were dozens of packages to choose from, and time had slowed to a dull lull, twin, full, queen, cotton, linen, blends, thread counts. I stared at the wall of bed sheets, the tiny floral patterns, the soft pinks, the white sheets, all mashed together. I didn't know which package to choose. I pulled a few off the shelves and compared the prices. I had a queen-size bed, so I was shopping for a queen-size set. But I didn't know what the sheet was for. I didn't know if it was going to be destroyed. I kept looking at the prices, but the numbers were spinning in circles. Nothing was fixed. And the lights above hummed and buzzed, and the walls seemed to be breathing darkly. And tears seeped from the corner of my eyes, like rainwater that can't permeate the saturated earth. I felt muddy, confused. The phone rang, and I answered. You're late, Cher said. I don't know what sheet to buy, I said. Hurry, she instructed. You don't have much time. Cher's storefront fortune-telling office was tiny and efficient. We usually sat in the front room where she did her readings. It was just big enough for 2 king chairs and a little side table for her cards and crystal ball. The walls were sponge painted gold and red, and there were floating shelves for her crystals and candles and spiritual baths. And there was an astrological wheel of the year made out of plaster and spray painted silver and gold, which hung not from the ceiling, but from this half wall. Her office was always cold as an icebox and spotlessly clean. "Did you bring everything?" Cher asked as she opened the interior door and led me into a living room so small that all the furniture seemed to be in miniature. A tiny leather couch, a narrow glass table, and six diminutive chairs. It was quiet and solemn. I reached into the tote bag and pulled out the sheets. Cher moved quickly. My eyes darted around the room as she opened the package, removed the flat white sheet, and spread it neatly on the floor. In the back was a kitchenette with a mini fridge, a sink, and a hot plate. Makeshift steps led up to a lofted area that I couldn't see. Everything was silent. Her husband and children were nowhere to be seen. Cher and I were alone with the ritual. "Give me the quarters," she ordered. My hands clawed in the bag. Cher took the quarters and began breaking open the paper rolls. The coins rang against each other as they fell in silver piles on the white sheet on the floor. "And did you bring the money?" I reached into the bag and pulled out 24 $100 bills. "Sit," Cher gestured to the floor. So I sat, cross-legged on the white sheet, holding the money in my hands. "Now," she said, "something is coming. Something very, very big is coming, and we must protect you." "What is it?" I was afraid. "What's coming?" "Don't worry about what it is. The important thing is that I'm going to build a barrier around you so that no harm can get through." "What are you going to do?" I asked. "We must build a silver shield," she said mysteriously. "Now, the money you hold in your hands, you are to pray for protection, and then use to blow on it three times." I closed my eyes and shivered. "I'm cold," I said. "Concentrate, sweetie. Focus." I held the money in my hands. And I prayed for freedom, for protection, whatever that was. My breath touched the money, and I opened my eyes and saw Cher's hand extended toward me. I placed the money in her palm, and she swiftly tucked it away. "Now lie down," Cher gestured to the sheet on the floor. I was afraid. "Do I have to be naked?" I asked. Cher laughed. "Of course not, sweetie." "Can you turn off the air conditioning, please?" I lay on the floor, trembling, my arms just open, a bit like wings. Cher thought for a moment, then reached for the remote. The rumble of cold air stopped blowing. I lay on the floor and closed my eyes. Now Cher was moving around me, above me. I could hear the quarters clinking against each other. She worked quickly, praying over me first in English, "In Jesus' name, protect this woman, in Jesus' name," and then in a language I did not understand. I lay perfectly still and breathed deeply into my own prayers. And what is next is clouded, as if I was sinking through the floor, back through space and time, and forward into an unknown future. I passed through the door that opens in deep meditation, into that place beyond thought, beyond dreams, a place of stillness, the place where everything is a unified field of light. When I close my eyes, I can almost still access that place, though dimly, journeying back through the years. I open my eyes and find myself on the floor of the Ofisa. Cher's face hovered over me, her eyes placid, serene, her dark hair hung like a beautiful veil, crowned in a halo of light. She looked peaceful and gentle and pure. "You look like an angel," I said. Cher took my hand and helped me to my feet and gestured to the floor, where a silver halo of quarters radiated outward around the shape of my body. Cher had arranged the quarters around my body in gleaming concentric rings, like a silver snow angel. It was the most beautiful thing I had ever seen. "You also have an angel inside you," she said. I was overwhelmed by the idea that there was anything angelic in me. How could I have any recourse with the angels? Just below the surface of my pleasant personality was the abiding knowledge that I was bad, evil, broken. I cried as Cher swept the quarters up and bundled them into the sheet. "You also have an angel inside you," Cher said again, "but there's a lot of work you need to do. This week you need to go back to the Philadelphia house." "I don't want to go back there," I said. "I understand that," she said, "but you don't need to be afraid, because now you are protected. And listen to me now, this is important. Spirit tells me there's something else in the house you need to find. Now let me ask you this. Is your mother home there now?" "No," I said, "she's still at the lake." "Good," Cher said. "Then this is the time. You need to go back to Philadelphia. Spirit tells me there's something important that you need to retrieve from that house. Something related to your childhood." "What is it?" I asked. "You'll know it when you see it," Cher said cryptically. Then she opened the door and turned me out onto the street, where it was midsummer and alive with young people and lovers and mothers pushing young children in carriages. And I stepped into the throng of the world and felt I was protected, swept up, and carried home on the golden tide of humanity. 3 days later, I was preparing for the trip. At Cher's instruction, I was to return to my mother's house, to the house I grew up in, to look for clues hidden in the attic, in the basement, between the walls. Cher insisted that there was something there, and it was my job to find it. I packed only the necessities. I needed a key and a headlamp. I needed a change of clothes, and I needed a plan. Where would I look first? The attic, certainly. The attic wasn't really an attic, but a secret room hidden behind a mirror over a dressing table in the master bedroom. I would look in the old trunk in the basement and in the eaves. I would look in the coffee cans in the garage. I made a mental map. I knew where I was going and what I was going to do when I got there. I was high on the revelations and expectations, and I was exhausted. It was early evening when I lay down to rest for a moment, and the sun was still in the sky. At midnight, I was wrenched from my dreams by the sound of an alarm. It was very dark, and for a moment I didn't know where I was, but I had been there before, lived there for years in that space between asleep and awake, in the shadow of a recurring dream I had had since adolescence. This, my worst nightmare. In the dream, I was running from something. I was with a friend, and I didn't know who or what we were running from, but we were very afraid. We were running through the woods. It's an ugly place, alive only with danger. And then something bad happened. My friend tripped and fell down, mauled by the black force that pursued us as I ran on ahead. Her body swallowed by the dark, lapping waters. As always, I tried to swim down to save her, but she's no longer herself. In the dream, the death is an accident, but it's my fault. And her mother is searching, calling through the darkness for her daughter, like an alarm. And I know where she's buried, but I can't speak. And her mother keeps searching, calling her daughter's name into the void. The alarm split through my dark apartment and pulled me all the way out of the dream. I tried to turn off the alarm, but it wasn't coming from my phone. It wasn't the smoke detector or a car alarm or a passing siren. It was a low, incessant tone that cut through the whole neighborhood, permeating everything. I closed my eyes and clamped my hands over my ears, but the alarm wouldn't stop. And for the first time, I knew my nightmare wasn't a dream. It was a memory. Shaking, I put on my clothes and went down to the street. The sky was red dark and the streetlights were on, and the alarm sounded through the whole neighborhood, a low moaning siren. Was there a bomb, a flood? I ran back inside and closed all the windows. The glass dampened but did not block out the sound of the alarm. In my experience, the recovery of a repressed memory is not total revelation, but more the acquisition of language. I suddenly had words for a feeling I had never spoken before. I pieced together the images that had been haunting me for years, and they crystallized into a narrative, and all at once I found words for the secret I had been keeping from myself. I called Cher. I knew what I wanted to say, but when she answered the phone, I couldn't get the words out. I was crying too hard. "Are you there, sweetie?" But I was choking, sobbing, gasping for air. Now, Cher was alarmed. "What is it?" Finally, I managed to say it. "He killed her," I gasped. "My father killed her." "Killed who? Killed who?" Cher's voice was high, intense. "What are you talking about?" But I couldn't get out the words. Cher was pragmatic and had a maternal solution for everything. She told me to take a deep breath, meditate, drink a glass of water, fix myself something to eat, even if it was just dry white toast, take a hot shower, get some rest, and come see me tomorrow. I don't know how I got through that night, or through that week, or how I had lived my whole life to that point. But suddenly all the pieces fit together into this terrible, ugly puzzle, and everything made terrible sense. I was sitting in Cher's Ofisa when I found the words. I pieced together the flashes of dreams and nightmares and memories and assembled them into a story. "Something happened the summer I was 11 years old," I said. "My father and I went for a drive. I have a good sense of direction. I remember all the roads he used to drive me on when I was a child. Like part of me was tracking a way back. But that day, he took me somewhere I'd never been before. And like maybe he took me to a playground or a park. And I met a child and we played together. And then he asked if we wanted ice cream, and she got in the car. I don't know what happened next. But later, when we were back home, he was hiding something in the back bedroom. There was this cabin next door,
And I remember him locking the door, and then I remember him, maybe he was burying something in the woods or carrying something. I don't know. But he said, "Look what you did. Look what you did, Neen. Look what you made me do." I think he killed her. My eyes were fixed on Cher's crystal ball, and I was rocking back and forth, inconsolable. He killed her. I think he killed her. "You don't know that for sure," Cher advised calmly. I glared at her. "I know what happened." "Sweetie, you don't know what happened. And you've got to stop blaming yourself. You don't know what happened for sure. And whatever it wasn't your fault. You was a child." "We didn't have a phone in the house," I said. "I mean, there was a payphone in the park. And I remember lying in bed for like weeks, imagining how I would get up in the middle of the night and sneak out of the house, go to the park and call the police. But I was too afraid of what would happen if he caught me. And like, I just like imagined it over and over, but I never made the call. I never did. I never said anything. I never did anything. I never said anything." "You didn't do nothing wrong," she said. "You was a child and you did as you was told." "But I knew," I said, "I knew it was wrong." "No one ever taught you right from wrong," Cher said firmly and with compassion. "But I'm grown now," I sobbed. "I know now." "You're still learning," she corrected me. "And that's my job, to teach you your rights from your wrongs." "I have to call the police," I said. "I have to call the police now." "No." Cher shook her head slowly. I took my phone out of my pocket. "I have to call the police now." "You're not making sense," Cher said. I started to dial, and Cher gently took the phone out of my hands. "You can't do that," she said. "I have to tell what happened. Her mother," my voice cracked, "her mother is looking for her. I have to tell what happened. Her mother needs to know." "Her mother already knows," Cher said softly, releasing my hand. She placed my phone face down on the table and covered it with her palm. "Her mother already knows in her heart. A mother always knows." "I have to tell what happened," I said. "You can't do that," Cher said. "Because if you do, who do you think they'll blame?" Cher raised an eyebrow and looked at me hard. "It doesn't matter," I said. "I have to do the right thing. I have to tell." "Telling now won't solve nothing." Cher's voice was firm. "If you call the police, best case, they won't believe you. Worst case, they come after you. They'll blame you. Who else is there to blame? You won't help nobody by coming forward now. You won't help her family, won't give them peace. You'll just make problems for yourself." I buried my head in my hands. "Trust me," she said. "You are protected, remember? Do as I say, and everything will be fine." I was no longer a child, but I'd been following orders my whole life. And I'm ashamed to admit I obeyed. When I told Miriam the story, she didn't exactly believe me. She didn't not believe me, but she did have questions. She wanted me to slow down. She wanted details and dates. And so I tried to give her what she wanted. It was 1993, late July or early August. Upstate New York, the summer I was 11 years old. Something bad happened. How could I explain it? He took me somewhere. I made a friend. He took us out for ice cream. He took her for a ride and she never went home. "So, where were you?" she asked. We were at the lake, but he took me somewhere else. We went for a drive somewhere I'd never been. To blow the stink off. That's what he called it when he went out for a drive. Sometimes, only sometimes, he took me with him. To the bank, to the bookstore, to a boat show, for a long, long drive down a tree-lined highway. "Where did you go?" Miriam asked. "I don't know, it was a place I'd never been before. Maybe it was a park. Maybe I made a friend at a playground, and that maybe he took us out for ice cream. I don't know exactly." And then my heart was in my throat. I couldn't breathe. Every images were coming to me in flashes. And then he locked her in the bedroom next door of the lake house, Miriam asked. "No," I said. "Was this old camp next door. There were these 5 little cabins. My grandparents owned them all. And the 5th cottage was unfinished. And he took her there to the 5th little cottage. It was under renovation. And no one was living there." I knew the answers to her questions, but I couldn't bear to say the words out loud. My body was clenched in a scream. "How old was she?" Miriam asked. "I was 11, I said. "But how old was she?" she pressed. "Miriam, I don't remember. About the same age, a little younger, a little older. I don't know, she was a child." Miriam opened her laptop and began Googling dates and places and missing children. "I already did that," I said, rocking back and forth between convulsions. I couldn't find anything. Miriam wanted to try again. "If a child went missing," she said, "it would be in the news." "It was a long time ago," I said, "before the internet. I don't know how far back the records go." "If a little white girl went missing," Miriam said, "it would be in the newspaper." "What if she wasn't white?" I asked. "What if she was native, or her parents were undocumented and didn't have papers? Would they have called the police? And if they did, would the police have taken it seriously? Would it have been reported in the papers?" "I don't know," Miriam admitted, "but when a child goes missing, there's a record." "I need to lie down," I said, but I couldn't move from my chair. Miriam frowned and turned back to the computer. "He killed her," I said, clutching my knees. "What if," Miriam said slowly, "what if it happened, but in a different way than you remember? You know, it may be that he killed you. What I mean is that it may be that he did something so bad to you that he killed something inside of you. I've read about things like that happening. Something so bad happens that a part of your mind kind of splinters or separates or dissociates, and it becomes like a separate being. So maybe he didn't kill another child. Maybe what you're remembering is that he killed a part of you." Miriam touched my back as I rocked back and forth. "No," I said, "he killed her. He killed her." "For something like this," Miriam said, "we need to find some kind of proof." Miriam was looking for facts, for alternate explanations, which I could understand. I too wanted it not to be true. I too wanted corroboration. But more than that, I wanted to be heard. It was like I had just found the words for something I had repressed for so long, and now I was confessing my truth. Eventually, I lay down on the bed and stared blankly at the wall until Miriam turned out the lights. When I awoke, it was dawn, and Miriam was perched at the foot of my bed. She regarded me with gravity, and her face was drawn into a frown. "What's wrong?" I asked. "You were crying out in your sleep," she said. "What was I saying?" I asked. "I don't know," she hesitated. "A lot of things. I couldn't make sense of it. But it sounded like you were running, like you were trying to get away from something." "I think," she said, sadly and shaking her head, "there must be some kind of truth in your dream." Miriam didn't necessarily believe the words that were coming out of my mouth, but she could tell I was wrestling with a very dark force. "I don't know what exactly happened," she said, "but something happened. Something very bad must have happened. It's eating you up. And the body cannot lie."
Thank you for listening to Investigative Poetics. Just when you think you've reached the end of the story, you realize it's only begun.
Stay tuned. A new episode will be coming soon. Investigative Poetics is an ongoing real-time investigation. This project has taken years of research, writing, fact-checking, interviews, studio time, and web development. And up to this point, I've been personally funding the project. Now, in order to keep it going and reach a broader audience, I'm asking for your support. If this story has moved you, challenged you, and stayed with you, please consider supporting it on Patreon. Visit patreon.com/investigativepoetics to make a contribution and help solve the mystery. Investigative Poetics is written by Even Christine Gardner. The theme music is by Bobby and Max McVitie, with sound production by Michael Lesko, web design by Marco Jovic, art and graphics by Nicole Franco, and photography by Jeannie Tsai and Emily Dryden.
If you or anyone you know has information pertaining to the events described in this or any of the episodes, you can message me at contact@investigativepoetics.com, and I will follow any leads and any tips that you can provide.